Hello and welcome to Carbon Dialogue, a forum to discuss all things sustainable. I'm your host Siddharth Dasgupta, bringing you green perspectives from industry experts, academicians, and seasoned practitioners. Carbon Dialogue aims to break down pressing issues in the climate space and understand the solutions needed to tackle them. As an avid learner of the space, I want to reach out to all the curious souls who want to make a difference and be more conscious. Let's change the world one conversation at a time. You can follow us on Apple, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. Hello, everyone. Sustainable development, an oxymoron or a reality? Today, I have with me Paul Goydan, a climate and sustainability specialist and a seasoned practitioner from BCG, who will help us navigate this question and few others. And along with it, he will give his perspective on critical issues in this space. So join me in welcoming Paul. Hi, Paul. How are you?
I'm great. It's a pleasure to be here and to spend time on the podcast talking about one of the most important and existential issues of our time that we're going to have to face as a society.
Great. Thanks a lot, Paul, for actually taking out this time. This is really very helpful. Honestly, we have been talking for a long time, but it's been our schedules that we all are very busy and usually do not get the actual time to talk about things where we really feel passionate about and we really want our people or people who we care for, or in fact, for this kind of a situation where the entire world is something which is dealing with a lot of uncertainty. We really want, at times, we really want our voices to go out and about. There are people we are working on a regular basis in northern part of America and few other parts of the world. But I feel right now the way the entire social media is going and so many platforms are there, I feel podcasting is one of the amazing ways to put your views out in the public and have those meaningful and rich conversations with practitioners and industry experts like yourself and policymakers and even academicians. In fact, the whole nine yards. So great. Thanks a lot for coming here. And while we are shooting this episode in midst of COP27, we just surpassed Finance Day. We also surpassed the Decarbonization Day. A lot of chats are happening and a few of the announcements have taken place in the past 2 days. While all this is happening, where do you see the energy and the food security related to the Russian invasion of Ukraine going this winter into well about 2023 or maybe even bigger than 2024?
Yeah, it's just an absolutely amazing backdrop to be having the conversations on climate change. It has brought energy to the forefront as a conversation topic. And I think that may be a very small silver lining in what is a tragic humanitarian issue, that actually we are now realizing the importance of the energy ecosystem to not just powering society, but in chemicals and fertilizers and food transportation. In addition, we are realizing in Europe, in the United States, that energy security and green energy go hand in hand. And so while we are going to have a very tough winter, and especially the people of Ukraine are in a real fight for survival, we are going to use this moment, I believe, and I'm seeing with my clients, to pivot to different, greener, and more secure sources of energy. I think your opening question on sustainable development is actually the puzzle that we're all here to solve, the challenge of climate change. The world has to develop. We have people, millions and millions of people who live without adequate energy, adequate clean fuel to cook. So we must develop. It is the just thing to do in society and a very big conversation, as you mentioned, COP. But we also need to do it sustainably. We cannot continue to pollute with greenhouse gases at the rate we have in the past. And so it's not an oxymoron. It's a challenge to society that I think we can rise and tackle that challenge.
I love it the way you have brought about the entire flavor into this question, which is essentially driving pretty much everybody in this part of the world crazy. A lot is happening around Russia, Even there are a few energy practitioners at CGEP at Columbia. They have been talking a lot about how exactly people should be prepared, what exactly is happening. And recently, Columbia organized the Global Energy Summit. So where even policymakers from countries like Kenya came. And then one of those panels had a speaker coming from Russia. She is working for CGEP. And she is, I think, partially based out of Russia and partially based out of US. The way she portrayed the entire picture was, it was kind of grim. And the way things are looking for not just Europe, but it might have a domino effect, cascading effect towards outreaching parts of Scandinavian countries. While they may not have a direct linkages, but the domino effects will reach even those regions, those countries as well. So when you actually spoke about those, it just brought that particular conversation into my mind. While she was very critical about the future, I actually felt the pain in her voice, the way she was talking. And she actually threw a lot of numbers, which obviously I don't have right now handy with me. But the way she has portrayed the entire panel, she's not very hopeful of having a great winter, not just this winter, but even the next winter. So that's what her projection was. Do you have any of your views, maybe not based on this, some of your own personal views?
You've actually hit on a really critical topic, and it's something where we have a tremendous practice in the EU. And I was just in Berlin several weeks ago talking to the leaders of German companies and some of the leaders in our practice. This winter, Europe is going in to the coldest months with about 94% of their storage full. They have done a tremendous job buying gas on the open market, and they had the benefit of refilling storage with still some Russian gas flowing at the beginning of the year. The EU targets about 80% full on storage going into the winter months, so we have a good buffer. But you hit the nail on the head when you said, what about next winter? And I think that's the question, because we won't in Europe have made a dent yet in clean energy. It takes time to build and install a step change in your grid in terms of transmission lines and wind and solar, and even some of their ambitions on bringing in green hydrogen. But we don't have the benefit of that next year. It takes time. We don't have the benefit of the Nord Stream pipelines of Russian gas to refill storage next year. And so I do think Europe is going to have probably an okay 2022-23 winter, but the following year is going to be tough. That's going to be where we're at the real critical point between building new infrastructure, getting new gas import, liquefied gas import online, and still getting storage to the point where we're comfortable having a cold winter. So I think we are well prepared. We seem well prepared for this winter, barring really extreme cold weather events in Europe or further degradation of critical infrastructure. But next year is going to be tough because we're not going to have the storage position that we have this year.
That's really interesting to know, Paul. In fact, I have been talking to a few of my, coming from a consulting background, I have been, it's not so easy to say a bye to consulting world after working for 7 years. Your clients keep on remembering you, they keep on texting you, they keep on asking you for advices, because you know how government clients are specifically. If they really find their comfort zone, they really go back. So coming back, there have been questions arising from India as well, where they have been talking about, obviously, Dr. Jaishankar, External Affairs Minister, was at Colombia, and the same question was asked to him as well, that while the Russian oil is still being bought by India, why is India not taking a stand? But honestly, the middle-income countries are also feeling the pain, the heat. India may be an outlier. There are a few other countries coming from the middle-income zone. And from the low-income zone, they may not have that kind of a issue, because the colder part, the frigid parts, and the low-income country, it's that subset is a very narrow subset. But coming back to your last expression, I recently saw that BCG released its 16th annual report on the 50th most innovative companies. And the report evidences show that only 1 in 5 companies is ready to take effective action concerning climate and sustainability. despite 2 in 3 ranking it as a top priority. So my questions are, I've actually noted it down so that I ask you the exact same thing what I had in mind. What sort of market-based incentives do you think companies would respond well in terms of taking action against climate change and towards sustainability? It's quite a mouthful, but what I wanted to know is, like, what are those tools and techniques which are being actually taken care of, being thought over?
There's fundamentally two policy tools that most corporations embrace in slightly different, more nuanced ways, and that we think are going to have a tremendous impact. First, putting a price on greenhouse gases. We talk a lot about it, and we know from experience that pricing an externality in the market helps companies make better trade-offs and better decisions, and ultimately it can have a real material positive effect on pollution. And greenhouse gases are a pollutant. There are real challenges geopolitically with doing that. Greenhouse gas is a global pollutant. It's not local. And so you have to think about pricing it in some globally harmonized way. That geopolitically is incredibly tough. There are also many ways to think about how to price greenhouse gas, and different companies prefer different mechanisms. And so even if you could get a global harmonized accord, we need to get society in different countries to agree on the actual implementation and pricing mechanisms. And that is, particularly in democracies, incredibly hard to get that level of alignment on the nitty gritty. But many corporations say, give me a stable price on greenhouse gases that I can plan around and I will react to it, just like other policy tools that have worked, including reducing SOx and NOx and how we tackled acid rain several decades ago. So that's the first policy lever. There are some countries that have carbon pricing, that have greenhouse gas pricing, but then you have to say, is it high enough? Does it really reflect the social cost of carbon? Is it at the level where it's going to truly impact decision-making? And again, that comes down to actually how do we implement and execute the policies. But that is a very clear policy tool, which has a lot of momentum and a lot of history showing it can work. But it's politically very challenging. The second policy tool, which we just saw the U.S. enact with the IRA, is we can help immature technologies mature more rapidly with government support, and we can help build industries to support rapid green technologies with government support, and we can streamline and smooth infrastructure deployment. We know that we need trillions of dollars in new infrastructure if we're going to reduce the carbon in our economy, and governments can provide streamlining and incentives and tools, sort of the carrots approach versus the sticks approach, to encourage these industries reaching scale and cost competitiveness. And that's what we saw the U.S. do with the IRA, is what we call the carrot-based approach of finding subscale, newer technologies that can really decrease the greenhouse gas impact of society and then give the government support necessary to get them up and running and move them forward. And that's with hydrogen and carbon capture and electric cars and batteries and metals and refining of those metals here in the U.S. or free trade countries. All of those are tools to help build and develop technology and industries that will reduce greenhouse gases. So that's the other policy tool. Some would call it industrial policy, but we have to think about it and how do we get these industries to scale quickly, and how do we get the infrastructure that's really a public good accelerated where it needs to be.
That's really a very interesting perspective. In fact, the way I've been reading and studying the entire policies, in fact, coming from the middle-income countryside where things are not so easy. You need to really make it easy. You really need to pull your sleeves and get down and get your hands dirty. When I was working with Ministry of Forest and Energy Conservation back in India. So we did a feasibility study out there, whether the green hydrogen is possibly feasible in an ecosystem like a dense ecosystem like India. So interesting facts came out, which is now obviously in the public domain too, in their ministry website. The exact same tools what you just spoke about, it came out in our feasibility studies as well. both the way you just explained, the way it has been, it is aiming to help. Exactly those characteristics came out of our study as well. So this is really interesting to know. My second question is, what sort of public sector regulation do you think firms would respond well to?
When I talk to CEOs, and I think it's pretty much the same the world over, the first thing they say is, we like stability. And particularly with a lot of these low carbon technologies, you could be looking at transformative long life asset investments, 20, 30 year investments. So when we talk about regulation, companies accept regulation. They want it to properly balance business needs, societal needs, environmental needs. They want it to be fair and create a level playing field for competition. And most importantly, they want it to be stable. They want to be able to make with confidence. And I think we as a society want them with confidence to make long-term investment decisions that are lower carbon, lower greenhouse gas emitting. And so first and foremost, regulation has to exist and be clear and be stable for them to invest against. And then many of them don't want to see regulation that tips the playing field between different green technologies because they want to be able to compete and innovate. And that's a lot of what our innovation research is on, is how do we create a playing field that encourages low carbon innovation, low greenhouse gas intensity innovation, but doesn't inadvertently or overtly tilt the playing field to any one technology. Many of my clients say government shouldn't be choosing decarbonization technologies. They should be encouraging decarbonization at accelerated pace and let the free market compete to provide different technologies and see which ones work better at scale in different solutions. And then that's where regulation can be written that really moves industry forward.
That really brings me to one of my personal questions, which my personal favorite questions, which I always ask to practitioners, that while ESG is highly, it's not standardized yet. And it's a shame that it's not standardized yet, that it's been used the way things have been improving, evolving, and for different sectors, for different industries. It's just, and then we have different ratings where we are saying that these agencies are the best ESG certification providers and so on and so forth. My question always has, while I have been into that side of the table as well, in fact, where you are right now, there was a constant challenge which I faced. In fact, my entire team faced across EMEA, which is Europe, Middle East, India, and Africa, that while it is not standardized, it has a lot of danger. So while ESG is not standardized, implementing ESG reporting and having ESG assessments may be fatal if you do not have a lot of stuff going as per a standardized way. So while we are doing these, while we are conducting these ESG assessments and reportings, yes, these are a part of regulation because these are being considered as a part of the regulation. Do you see ESG reports being standardized in coming days, weeks, years time? Because I think it's high time these should be standardized to make sure that, yes, people have that kind of a belief and that faith in this tool that, yes, ESG works. There are people coming from The Economist and, they're writing that ESG is a sinking ship. It may not just work. It's just a reporting style, which people are just, it's a fancy reporting style. I would rather love to defer to all these allegations, although I don't have anything to do with ESG. But we started ESG with UK government in the year 2009 and 10. That was a time when people started talking about ESG. You being into this market, this mature market, what is your expert opinion? What do you see? Where do you see the ESG framework going ahead? And do you think it might just change in some time?
You've hit a very, very hot topic, and this is something that's being very actively discussed at COP. As you mentioned, we're recording this first part while COP is ongoing in Sharm el-Sheikh. We just finished a really groundbreaking piece of research with the Rockefeller Foundation, and better climate financing, more climate financing depends on better data. And that goes to the heart of what you just talked about in terms of reporting and how can we see and trust and use that trusted data to make better decisions. We know that we're going to have to deploy $3 to $4 trillion annually to really get to net zero by 2050. And that's across a range of investments. And what we found with the Rockefeller Foundation is a lack of complete and comparable data, especially about private sector climate performance and finance, hinders efforts to close the climate financing gap around the world. And so there is a lot of talk around getting quality data out there and how does quality data impact financing and impact climate change and emissions. And we see that it does. When there's timely, comparable, accurate data, it does make a difference in the decisions people make, and that makes a difference in the behavior of companies. And so we really think that self-reporting is a necessary step on the journey, but we do need, with governments around the world, to actually have comparable, trustworthy data that particularly investors can use to make wise decisions and to move their money where they want to have impact and get return.
Okay, so that's interesting. So at the end, what exactly would you think or what exactly your hunch would be? Where exactly the entire ESG reporting route or the path is heading towards? Is it heading towards being a standardized tool, or is it heading towards being the same pretty much for the next couple of years?
ESG is a very broad topic, and we may find that the E, the S, and the G are all very important in the long term to a healthy company. It may be too much to have them all together in one framework, particularly when we look geopolitically at comparable reporting, comparable data, and regulations. I really do think some of the international efforts to come up with a framework under IFRS or perhaps U.S. accounting to disclose greenhouse gas emissions, to disclose climate risk, could be very, very impactful. But that is only a part of the E, and the E is only part of ESG. And so we may, as a society, have to separate some of the topics, focus on what's urgent and important for society, which right now is getting in front of our changing climate, and say, what can we create on climate data specifically that is relevant to stakeholders, can be cost-effectively reported, and globally agreed so that we can compare and make decisions? And that may require, in this instance, tackling a more focused problem than everything that many people put under a broad ESG banner, which covers quite a range of topics.
That's a very practical way to look at it, honestly. And thank you, Paul, for throwing your sort of experience insights onto this. I go back to COP27, where while there's a, like, it's just started and there are a lot of days to still, I mean, there are a lot of topics to be covered. So what sort of changes, perhaps, are you hoping to see come out of this COP? While people are talking a lot about this COP as an Africa COP, which it is, I mean, is it happening in Africa? But then what are those sort of changes, while being a practitioner, you have your gut counting on? What are you hoping to see?
Well, there's a really, really important agenda at COP27, where we're talking about the state of implementation with massive regulation coming out of the EU, the EU countries, and out of the United States. So implementation and the speed of implementation is going to be a very rich topic, and the data around that. Having COP in Africa is allowing us to really have an open and honest conversation on adaptation and loss and damage, and how we as a society, as a human community, can try to help countries across different income levels mitigate and adapt to the dramatic impacts of climate change. And this is a very, very hard conversation. And COP27 is putting it front and center, and hopefully going to start getting some progress on even some of the money under Paris that was promised to developing countries to adapt to and mitigate climate change. We're going to have continued dialogue on financing the $3 to $4 trillion a year we need, some of which will come to and through government programs, some of which will have to come from private sector's investment. And then that's all underpinned by continuing to talk about a just transition, to talk about energy security, to talk about food security in the context of mitigating climate change. So it's going to be a very, very rich dialogue. It's going to be against a dynamic backdrop. We're already seeing that in the early conversations that have happened. We're also seeing that we have a lot of the energy industry invited and engaging in COP. And I hope that'll be constructive in getting all parties together to the table to move forward. But there's just a lot of really tough topics on the agenda. And I think we're going to see some progress. But we know these are geopolitically hard in the best of times. And now we're facing very high inflation, food shortages, energy shortages. And that's going to make substantial progress difficult. But I know everyone is there with good intentions, sort of pushing in this direction and at least talking about the really hard topics.
This is really obviously these topics around loss and damages. And in fact, each and every day has been carved out in a way that all these main themes have been addressed. World Bank is really on fire right now. They are like, I mean, fire in a very good way. So I mean, they are like really on a beast mode. They are like launching CCDRs after CCDRs. I mean, the other day they launched a CCDR for Egypt. I mean, needless to say that they are almost pretty much half of World Bank DC is in Sharm el Sheikh right now. So Egypt CCDR got out, Bangladesh was out, and I saw today Pakistan CCDR was also launched. And I was reading through the pages. In fact, Ethiopia CCDR is something where it really helped me a lot on understanding what exactly is happening around that part. So I was just reading these CCDRs and I saw that, I mean, it's been hinting towards, in fact, the discussions on the finance day as well, it's been hinting towards pumping more money into the existing climate funds and trying to devise more climate funds in days and like months and years to come. So they have a plan right now. While right now, as we speak, there are mainly 10 climate funds, which are really big, like the ones where the plans are being really approved and the loans are being disbursed and things have been moving. Out of those 10 major climate funds, including GCF and a few others, I think that's what it just says, all these meetings, that there might be few more climate funds coming up in the foreseeable future. So I just wanted to know from your background and your experience into this field, do you see a lot of synergy into the climate funds right now? Or do you see a lot of money being pumped into already existing climate funds? And or do you also see a few more climate funds coming in the foreseeable future, focusing on direct solutions? So maybe a climate fund can be only for agriculture, a climate fund can be only for EV space, and so on and so forth.
We're going to have to see more money flow towards these funds, towards these countries. That is very clear in the data that we've seen from the World Bank and others. And specialization does help. And we're very likely to see a shift from broader funds that try to cover topics to ones that become more specialized, that become more focused, that can develop the expertise and the capability to invest widely on each of the topics, whether it's adaptation or whether it's energy systems or whether it's food systems. And even under those, there's going to become more targeted funds, as well as handling afforestation and deforestation. I'm not sure where this is going to evolve, not just at COP, but over the next several years. But they're going to grow, and they're very likely going to be more specialized funds out there.
That's what I wanted to know. I mean, this is something which was very clear from the report, although it was not very explicit. So I thought it's always good to have different views and perspectives, what other experts think. Given your expertise in this energy sector, which is like quite nice, like the rich experience you have right now, would you like to share what is the biggest challenge you face working with the clients in this sector, just particularly in this sector, because there are like different government sectors?
I mentioned it before earlier in the podcast that one of the biggest challenges with the private sector is the concern about durable regulation and or a lack of specific regulation and government rulemaking around the world. That is the most important topic, I think, right now. We are seeing companies around the world want to invest, but they need a certain level of specificity and clarity, and then they need to have the confidence for their board and their investors that we're going to have durable, consistent regulations. So I think that that is really slowing down what corporations could be doing. And that's a whatever industry, whatever conversation I'm in, I don't think you can avoid conversations on the regulation side, on the government side, on the geopolitical side about what may change or happen between countries. And all of that creates uncertainty and ambiguity, which is the enemy of fast corporate decision making.
Hmm. So this is pretty much the same what the middle-income countries and the low-income countries are also facing, perhaps on a larger scale or even more complicated scale. So this is really helpful to connect the dots there. So going ahead, a thought comes that how exactly are companies starting to embed the risks from the climate change into their business models and operation? In fact, the entire strategy part, if we see, there is like the different consulting and then there are different strategy consultings. So while there's a lot of consultings happening across the world, across federal agencies, they really need good, great brains like yourself and what they exactly should be doing during these times. What is your view of how are companies starting to embed the risk from the climate change?
You asked a question that's at the heart of the work we do at BCG. And we're seeing pull in a couple of areas. Companies are first and foremost defining their ambition. They're creating a strategy and they're creating a roadmap around reducing greenhouse gas intensity. That is where the boards and the CEOs are and have been for the last couple of years. If I go beyond that, if I look at some of the companies that are really far ahead, they're looking at two additional areas. One is really, really deeply starting to get into their operations and how do I change and rewire my company's operations, my plants, my supply chain, my logistics to reduce the impact on the planet, particularly the greenhouse gas impact. And then many of our clients are looking at where are their opportunities created by the shift to address climate change, where I can build new net zero or low carbon businesses, where I can help consumers or businesses address a gap they have in their net zero strategy or their net zero ambition. So many companies are looking at this as an opportunity for new business models, new products, new services that fit well into the low carbon economy, into the net zero economy. And so there's a lot of work in operational transformation, in rewiring supply chains and partnering with vendors and service providers on scope three. But there's an equal effort and focus at the most forward-leading companies about the opportunities to really be a leader and create new impact and new businesses. And that's been a really, really fun area for us and our consultants to be part of over the last couple of years. And we think that'll only continue. When we look at tackling climate change requiring investing and moving around $3 to $4 trillion of the global world economy, there are going to be many new products and services and capabilities that are needed that our clients are trying to create.
This is really enlightening to know because a lot of the readings which I do, not just while I'm at Columbia, but also while I'm at different forums doing a couple of other stuff too. So a lot of reading has to go. Like I can't believe that my reading has gone from like 500 pages a month to almost 3,000 pages a week. So it's crazy. And while I read all sort of trash, I also come across stuff which just tells me like how many ways are there right now that while you just nail on the head that how exactly companies are starting to embed the risk. And if I go through all these different articles and in the journals, not the books, I'm talking about nature.com and different journals, which are like environment specific. There's a whole lot of a list, which like, I feel like they replenish the list pretty much every fortnight. So there are like new points coming up every time I read it. So it's just very refreshing to know that, yes, experts and practitioners are putting their foot forward, in fact, to get their clients' job easy. And while you guys do what exactly you're doing, these things are really important at the core soul of it. I guess these were the questions which I really had like really in my head while I was thinking that, yes, I'll be interviewing you. There was another thing which I also noted down, that a relatively new problem for companies in the energy sector is like cyber attacks. While 80% of professionals in the energy space believe a cyber attack on the industry is likely to cause some operational shutdowns and damage their critical infrastructure, less than half of these companies believe they should be making urgent improvements in these areas. Any thoughts you would have to like support or going against this?
You've touched on a really important topic, and the war in Ukraine, particularly in the early days, really highlighted risk from to infrastructure, to energy assets, from cyber attacks, from particularly state actors and even some non-state actors. Many energy companies operate a very reactive cyber stance. And you're right, I don't think we're putting enough into cybersecurity given the threat that it poses to critical infrastructure, much of which is energy infrastructure. We all remember 2 or 3 years ago when the Colonial Pipeline was attacked by very simple ransomware, and the Northeast fuel prices spiked because we couldn't get the critical fuels to the Northeast United States because the pipeline was hit by ransomware. So cybersecurity is one of the topics that needs to be on every CEO's mind, whether it's a midstream company, an oil refinery, power transmission and grid operators. There are thousands of cyber events targeting critical infrastructure every single day that members of the public don't know about. And it's not a technical problem. One of the most interesting things the cybersecurity group at BCG finds, very interestingly, is 3/4 of cyber attacks, the root cause is organizational process and people failures. Meaning we didn't follow the rules. We gave in inadvertently to social engineering and possibly gave out passwords or other security credentials. 3/4 of failures come down to organization, people, and process. And companies will invest easily in very sophisticated hardware and technology, but the vast majority of cyber incidents come down to people's and processes in your company. And that's an area where we don't think CEOs are putting near enough focus given the risk profile it poses.
And what do you think the reason is, like, why CEOs are not putting their best foot forward in this?
Cyber risk is just like any other low probability, high severity risk. It's complicated. It's very tough to get the balance correct. Many CEOs didn't grow up getting trained in thinking about cyber risk. And so it is a topic that needs much more conversation at all levels of the company. And it also requires an investment and a focus, particularly when 3/4 of your failure come from processes and behaviors in your workforce. You have to constantly focus on that. So it's a very tough nut to crack, but it's a critical one and one we really want CEOs and boards to spend more time on.
I'm so glad that you supported the facts and you said exactly what I was actually expecting you to say, because that is something where while it is low probability, it's super high risk. I mean, if it happens, it just takes away pretty much everything or whatever the entire infrastructure is built on. So I guess we had a great 40 odd minutes of conversation, which has been amazing and enriching way of looking into things and the problems within energy and sustainability from a different perspective. And we all thank you within our podcast team. We all thank you, Paul, for your time and the way you have been able to manage this 1 hour. Before going, I would like to request you to perhaps give a sort of a message to our listeners, what exactly your message would be for people, because the listeners we have, it is like we have listeners from across consulting, federal agencies, academia, pretty much everyone. So I would love to hear your closing remarks and what is that advice you would like to give to our listeners?
I'm going to go back to how you opened the show and really think about sustainable development, not as an oxymoron, but as a challenge that all of us as citizens, as individuals and companies, as students, that all of us can play a small part in thinking through how we can change things to both reduce our impact on the planet and increase the prosperity of individuals around the world. So I think that is a challenge for us to rise to and not an oxymoron. And if you look at it that way, hopefully we'll go into our lives and see things a little bit differently. This is a very complicated topic, everything around climate change. I say if it was easy, we would have solved it already. But it's going to take all of us doing something a little bit different in our lives, in our companies, and thinking a little bit differently to tackle. And so if we can take that away, we're going to continue to make progress.
Great. Thanks a lot, Paul, for your time and your the wonderful insights you've shared with us. We really look forward to having these meaningful insights coming from you. And at the end of the show, I would like to tell to our listeners that I will be fixing Paul's coordinates on LinkedIn and all his social handles. And I think everyone should follow Paul and his thoughts, the way he has been super articulate about his views. And in fact, I have been following his thoughts for past few weeks, and I have nothing but just enlightened with absolutely new perspectives pretty much every time I read them. So I encourage every one of you to go and see what Paul's exact work domain, how exactly he's been interacting with his followers. And I'm sure you will also get benefited. Thanks a lot for listening to this amazing episode with Paul Goydan. And we'll meet you in our next episode. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.